understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined by Phil Knox, an Evangelism and Missiology Senior Specialist at the Evangelical Alliance. Phil is also the author of two books, Story Bearer and most recently, The Best of Friends. Phil, we've talked a little bit about friendship in the previous episode, but we're going to continue that conversation. And I want to point you to this page in your book where you talk about, if for anyone listening, I'm holding Phil's book up to the screen, and there's just this beautiful diagram of sort of a circle within a circle within a circle within a circle. And you talk about circles of friends in your book, yeah. The Best of Friends. I mean, why can't we just be great friends with everyone? Phil, you're a friendly guy. I mean, why can't you just be friends with every single person?
When my kids go to Sunday school, I tell them, if they're a bit like me, they're a bit distracted, I tell them, if you don't hear the question, don't know the answer. 90% of the time, the answer is Jesus. So the reason that we can't be deep friends with everybody is that Jesus wasn't deep friends with everybody. And he was really, really intentional. But the reason that's the case is that, again, in the divine mystery of the incarnation, Jesus is fully God and fully human. But in his humanity, he inhabits finite relational capacity and finite time. And we don't have all of the time and relationship capacity available to be able to invest as well as we could in everyone. And what's fascinating is, in the last few years, there's been some fascinating research around the circles of friends. And so you've just got a book out. I'm going to get a book out. A guy called Robin Dunbar, who wrote this book. Again, if you're just listening, it's a book called Friends by Robin Dunbar. And he wrote this book. And he's a leading, not yet Christian, anthropologist, evolutionary biologist. And what he did was he tried to find the kind of correlation between the brain sizes of monkeys and their social grouping. And he found that the bigger the brain, the bigger the social grouping was. So he said, you know, if we're mapping this forward in terms of humans, what's the kind of relational capacity biologically of a human? And he came up with this number about 150. And so 150 is kind of about the average of the capacity of our relationship. Now, if you're listening to this and thinking, I haven't even got 20 friends, let alone 150. Don't worry. You're not meant to have 150 friends. That's just your capacity for people who you can know well. Then what Robin Dunbar did is he asked, how many good friends can you have and how many great friends can you have? And he found you can have about 12 good friends and about 3 great friends. And as I'm reading this, as I'm researching friendship, I'm like, that sounds really familiar. And it turns out that the Son of God, when he came to invest in his relationships, he had a very similar pattern. So in the book, I make the tangible jump between, you know, Jesus had a 72 in Luke 10 who he invested in. You add on the women, you add on the other friends that he had, and I reckon you get to about 150. But we also do know that Jesus had 12 friends who he invested in. You know, there's, I think there's a cheesy line in the book that says something like, Jesus' greatest miracle wasn't the feeding of the 5,000, it was having 12 close friends in his 30s. And so he has these kind of 12 friends who he invests in, who are his good friends. Then he has Peter, James and John, who are the great friends. And so one of my encouragements is in the book is to think about those relational circles and think about many of us, as I've researched the book, many of us have lots of friends in the outer layers, but not so many of the inner layers. Or we feel stressed and frantic because we've got an inner circle of like 20 and we wonder why we're stretched and strained and our WhatsApps are full. So one of my encouragements is to just really think strategically and intentionally and purposefully about those circles and have a really healthy balance of great friends, good friends and just friends.
I mean, you mentioned there that Jesus' inner circle was Peter, James and John. Why is 3 the magic number, for want of a better?
I don't know. I think probably it's how we were created. You know, seemingly the science and the scriptures basically seem to back that up. I think it just depends on our, you know, in the book I talk about the kind of values of friendship, and we just don't have enough time to invest in a wide range. And I think it depends on frequency of contact as well. So for me, I've got, with my job and my family and church life, I've got just about enough time to see my best mate once or twice a week and have a good chat. And he can look me in the eyes and say, how are you doing? And I can do the same for him. And then the others in my inner circle are my wife, who I see more than once a week, thankfully. but also I have a phone call with my brother and sister. I've really pushed the boundaries with four. But that's kind of my inner circle. I wish I had more time to invest in great people and to make other people feel more valued. I just don't. And I think for me, that's why it's a real challenge. But also that's why when you have to come to reality, like, it's really hard, because you have to choose. We have to choose how we spend our time. And we have finite amounts of it.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about sort of how we choose those friendships and how we create those friendships. But before we do that, while we're talking about Jesus, as I was reading your book and sort of, you know, thinking about Jesus and the close friends that he had, it did make me think, is it kind of uncomfortable, do you think, that Jesus didn't really treat all of his friends in the same way? I mean, do you think his approach to friendship is kind of at odds with the belief that Jesus should love everyone equally? Or is it a really separate thing? Can he sort of love the people that he's not best friends with?
Right. But I also don't think we get to create God in our own image, right? So if we were making a perfect Jesus, we'd probably make him friends with everybody. We don't get to choose what Jesus. That's at the heart of huge amount of issues within the Christian world at the moment. But that's the first thing. I think the second thing is, it does create. I think, do you know who I feel most sorry for? Andrew. Because James and John in the inner circle, brothers. Peter in the inner circle, brother of Andrew, it's Andrew who introduces Peter to Jesus. I'd have been gutted. Can you imagine the moment, right, where they get to the foot of Mount Hermon, which is where the Mount Transfiguration takes place. And he says, you know, Thomas, Bartholomew, you know, you're staying there. Philip, you're staying there. Both, Simon, you're staying there. You know, Andrew, Andrew's like, what? What? It just would have been really awkward. But I think Jesus clearly is modelling something there. And even then, you know, Peter, James and John are useless at times as well. You know, Gethsemane, Jesus is at his lowest, the lowest ebb spiritually. Father, would you take this cup from me? Peter, James and John come with him and they fall asleep. I reckon Andrew was there back there awake. I think it's a really interesting tension that I think raises both of those issues. And doesn't give us a get out of jail free card when we exclude people, because we need to do that lovingly and sensitively, but does encourage us to think carefully about how we spend our time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that and sort of how we create some of these friendships. What are some of the key ingredients, do you think, for good friendships?
Yeah, again, the answer is always Jesus, isn't it? And so I guess looking first of all at that intentional piece that we've talked about, I think the next thing I'd say is that the beautiful, I think as I've been just lent so deeply into John 15, as a really fabulous picture of friendship, both with God and with others. And at the heart of that is that really famous verse, there is no greater love than they that lay their life down for their friends. And again, the first thing we need to say really is in relation to the circles, the challenge is that even that's quite the weakness of that model. It's quite a self-centered model, right? You're saying, I'm at the center of the circles. Who are the people that I'm going to kind of have around me? And even we think about the power of friendship, there's a tendency to kind of think, you know, I should be a good friend and I should have friends because it gives me the gift of life. I think the flip side of that, when we say we lay our lives down for our friends, is we say, what's the gift of life that I can give to others? What's the gift of friendship? Who can I be a good friend to and be in their inner circle and at least offer that, whether they choose to reciprocate or not, that is there. So I think that sacrificial thing and the implications of that practically are things like, You can't be right all the time, you know, avoiding the need to be right. You know, sometimes the values of friendship and being friends with people who are different from you and being being in awkward social situations. Sometimes that's what friendship looks like. Sometimes it means when the proverbial hits the fan, it means dropping everything and not doing what you want to do. You know, I had a moment recently where a friend is going through a real storm in life. And I just got back from somewhere. I was absolutely exhausted. And I knew the right thing to do was to go and be with my friend. But I did so grudgingly. I was like, I picked myself off the floor and I was like, come on, Noxie, you need to get this. You wrote the book on friendship. But regardless, there's just something I think about the kind of the sacrificial nature. And then I think the other thing, kind of the other real value of friendship, which we might come on to, is there's just the diversity of friendship. You know, I think there's a beauty in being friends with people who are like us, but there's also something at the heart of good friendship where we kind of get to know people who are different from us and not only find common ground, but also hear the stories of others. And some of the most beautiful friendships, as I've researched the book, are across age differences, stories, ethnicities, differences between rich and poor. I think there's something so beautiful about that the church has to offer, that we have to offer through friendship with people who are different.
We need to take a short break, but before we get back to the discussion, I want to invite you to take a look at a new unbelievable course. It's called Did It Really Happen? The Birth of Jesus. Perhaps you've been asked questions about the historicity of Jesus, or maybe you have questions of your own. We've made an in-depth course with experts and theologians diving into the historical accuracy and arguments for and against the Jesus birth narratives. You will be guided through all areas of the discussion with N.T. Wright, Emil Ewing, Daryl Bock, and others. Check it out by visiting premierunbelievable.com/courses.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
You shared some, I thought, really quite harrowing statistics in your book. You know, you said that in the US, almost half of white people have no black friends, and a third of white Brits don't have any friends from an ethnic minority background. But why is diversity clearly so important in friendship?
I think, one of the breakthrough moments I had while researching the book was looking at the makeup of the disciples, right? So my premise is, I reckon seven of the disciples knew each other before Jesus called them. They were fishermen from Bethsaida. I think, let me see if I can remember them. Peter, James, John, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew and Thomas were all kind of from Bethsaida. They would have known each other, tight-knit fishing community, and clearly would have kind of got on. You know, I think very similar age, background, story, you know, ethnicity, probably would have laughed at the same things, voted the same way. I'm not sure the Romans were voted in, but, you know, it would all have been very similar. But then what I had this breakthrough moment as I researched was the kind of the diversity of the other disciples. And interestingly, even the 7-5 split is I think telling, where Jesus said, actually, most of your friends can be the same. You have, you know, real common ground. And we're wired like that. We're wired to connect with people who are similar to us. But then you have these five, and in the five is Simon the Zealot, who there were many different postures that the Hebrews took to the Roman occupation. One of them was, we're just going to kill the Romans. And Simon was a zealot. And then there was Matthew, who was not only a tax collector, but he was the worst type of tax collector, was known a little moches, who kind of basically was skimming off profits from the Romans, taxing imports and exports. You know, Jesus, when he calls Matthew, is from a tax collector's booth, which means that we know that Matthew was a little moches. And the tax collectors would have hated the zealots. And the zealots would probably not only have killed Romans, but killed tax collectors. Mm. So Simon and Matthew in the room for the first time would have wanted to kill each other. And Jesus so demonstrates here that we are meant to be friends with people who we disagree with. That's interesting, isn't it? In the 21st century, in a kind of cancel culture moment. And not only that, but the Bible so clearly demonstrates all the way through friendship of different ages, friendship with different backgrounds, and especially in a kind of multicultural, multi-story, multi-wealth, multi-age Britain, we need to ask the question, how do we be friends with people who are different from us?
And I guess, yeah, you touched on that, the kind of intergenerational friendship. We see that sometimes when it's done well within the church, don't we? Not always. But why is that so important, the intergenerational friendships? Because I guess often in the secular world, we don't see that. We see friends who are of similar ages, you know, whether that's because they're work colleagues and things like that. But why is intergenerational so important, do you think?
Yeah, I think again, from both the world and the Bible. So first of all, from a worldly perspective, there's some harrowing stats around how many over 70s, their closest friends, their television or their pets. So there's something about loneliness that can be solved by different generations. From a Christian perspective, there's some fascinating research from the States which looked at the characteristics of those in their 20s who are still going for it with Jesus. One of the key characteristics of resilient disciples is that they have what's called faith champions, older friends, not necessarily within the family, who they are friends with and who they can follow the example of and have conversations across the generations. So important. Then from a biblical perspective, I mean, this is really easy. You know, you look at throughout scripture, you know, you've got Elijah and Elisha, you've got Jesus and the disciples, you've got Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Timothy. And then the example I use in the book is Moses and Jethro. So Moses' father-in-law has this really catalytic relationship, friendship with, where he kind of corrects him, encourages him, challenges him. But throughout scripture, you've got this generation to generation. The Psalms talk about, we will commend your works from one generation to the next. In Judges, it says, this harrowing verse at the beginning of Judges that says, that generation knew neither the Lord nor what he'd done for Israel. Well, whose fault is that?
Yes.
Clearly the fault of the previous generation, right? They've not passed it on. So that's why intergenerational friendship matters so much.
I mean, one of the factors that you talk about in the book being a sort of a key ingredient for good friendships is vulnerability. That, again, seems to go sort of so opposite to what we're seeing in the world today,
right,
where, you know, it's all about, like, you know, being strong and things like that. But why is vulnerability so important, particularly when it comes to friendship, do you think, Phil?
I think there's layers of friendship that I think everyone listening to this will resonate with. And there's a moment where you go from just talking about, you know, how your sports team did or how work is, to a moment where you open your heart up. And in that moment, I've recognized it in myself, where you feel so vulnerable. You know, you feel open to attack almost, because that person could choose to reject you. They could choose to use that information against you. But more often than not, what I've observed is that person on the other side of the table opens up and says, can I tell you about my life and my challenges? And that leads to trust, first and foremost, probably, and then to a kind of an authenticity and a kind of, I've been through that too moment. I think it's Rob Parsons who says, if you want acquaintances, tell them your successes. If you want friends, tell them your hopes and your fears, and your failures. And there's something about a lot. And I've recognised the barriers, even with my best mate. When I'm at my best mate, if I've been stupid and done something, I recognise the reluctance to want to share that with him, because I want him to think I'm amazing. But I also recognise that if I don't do that, we lose the opportunity to build a bit of trust. But also, more often than not, he will then have the opportunity, and sometimes we'll then come back and say, I'm really struggling with this. And that's a really healthy dynamic in friendship. And you can't have people in your inner circles without moments of vulnerability, which lead to that next level and that deeper layer.
How do you think we get that balance right, though? Because we clearly shouldn't be, like, airing our dirty laundry in every friendship conversation. How do we get the balance between fun and all the things that are such important elements of friendship, but obviously being vulnerable and sharing and exposing the things that we don't necessarily want to expose?
Yeah, if you're not doing well and you go to church on a Sunday morning, it's okay for 90% of the people who ask you how you're doing to say you're fine. So long as when that one friend says, how are you doing? If your world's falling apart, you look them in the eye and you burst into tears. That's a, do you know what I mean? I think it comes down to time and intensity, doesn't it, Ruth? I think if I think about kind of, and this comes down to actually, if you don't spend enough time with your really good friends, those times will either become only fun or really, really intense. and neither of those things are good. Actually, there's a real balance that happens, isn't there, I think? But also, it's often when you spend loads of time with others that you then get the opportunity to go deep. So, good example of this, I went away last autumn with a bunch of mates who I have a variety of level of depth of relationship with. And we had an absolute ball. We climbed some mountains and went paddleboarding and, you know, had an absolutely fantastic weekend. But on the Sunday morning then, we just had a moment where we just went, how are we all doing? You know, and that I think I thought that might last half an hour. 3 hours later,
well,
you know, we'd all had that moment of depth. And now with each of those fellas, I can't tell you what that's done for the depth of our friendship with them. And that makes a huge difference.
So do you think we need to be physically meeting with our friends on a regular basis? Or is that something, I guess, in today's society where we're all sort of so all over the place, but also so connected through social media and, you know, we're chatting over video right now. We're not in the same space.
Yeah.
Can you be having those friendships in a sort of technological way as much as in a face-to-face interaction, do you think?
I think it's always going to be limited, if I'm really honest. I think there is something. I think we were created for presence and for touch. And so I've even, you know, I think in the book I talk about the need for a baby kind of growing up to if a baby is not held and looked at, the damage that does in the long term to us as humans. I think we're created as tangible people, and we're all on a spectrum, aren't we? You know, some of us will happily wear free hugs t-shirts. Others of us do not want an embrace anywhere, and that's okay. And recognizing that is part of the art of friendship. But I think the presence is so important. And in the book, I talk about the moments of grief in my life, and having people with me, and looking back on those moments, I just don't think it would be the same if I was, you know, with my best mate the night my dad died, when we're sat together crying together in the kitchen. That wouldn't have quite had the same impact over a Zoom screen or on FaceTime. I think my experience is that presence really matters. And I think presence, we could go down a whole theological track here of just presence being important and God's gift of his presence to us. Unless your presence goes with us, we will not go. You know, God, the beauty of the incarnation, God, could Jesus have related to humanity in the same way virtually? I'm not sure. There is something so powerful about God tabernacling, being with us. The word becomes flesh and moves into the neighborhood. That for me tells me that presence is important.
Phil, as we come to the end of this podcast, what are your top tips for creating and maintaining good friendships? And as you say, you know, being there, being present with our friends.
Yeah, I mean, I would add, we talk about presence, about vulnerability. The other value I would add for the big principle is time. You know, time is like oxygen to friendship. Those three things combine, if you're looking for the kind of vital ingredients, how to grow a friendship, those three for me will be the big ones. But in terms of practically, the first thing I don't think we do anywhere near enough is pray for friends. So we pray for all kinds of things. I pray for my sons that they had grown up to have really good friends. I pray for myself that God would introduce me to the right people. And in the book, we talk about how God is the great connector. God just, I love the idea of God as the kind of the orchestrator of the social network and going, those two guys, they're going to get on so well. Let's make that happen. You know, I really think that how Jesus at the cross connects John with his mother, just that power. So I pray. The second thing is that God's not the only connector at play. There are also some people who are really good at connecting people. And my advice is to get to know them. So I've got a mate called Andy, and Andy is just phenomenal at going, do you know this person? You need to get to know this person. And I reckon I know, I don't know, 10 to 20% of my friends because of Andy. And so if you've got people that you look at and go, they make this stuff look effortless. They're good at that. Get to know them a bit better. You hang around more with them, you'll get to know more people. I think that's, and churches are full of those kind of people. I think then there's an art to then kind of finding common ground, an art to the right questions, the right conversations. No one teaches us this stuff. There's very few books on this stuff. But I think there's something about kind of saying, my favorite question when I meet someone is, you know, what keeps you busy when you're not here? We're chatting on a, you know, whatever it is, a Tuesday. What keeps you busy on a Tuesday afternoon, Ruth, you know, normally or whatever? You get to know people's work or their hobbies. Asking open-ended questions. Tell me about this part of your life. getting to know people, finding common ground, the vulnerability piece we've touched on. And I think then there's something about, there's no substitute as well for being there in the highs and the lows of life for friends. And so, you know, I was best man at a wedding a couple of weeks ago. I spoke about the groom and said, I will never forget the moment when my mum died. They provided the bulk of our meals for the best part of 2 months. I'll never forget that. You know, in terms of my depth of my friendship with him, I'll never forget that. And so I think, and at the same time, that was a valley moment when mum died. On Saturday 2 weeks ago was a mountaintop. So we get to celebrate with the best of our friends, the mountaintops and the valleys of life, and making the most of those moments, and making choices to make sure we're there and offer ourselves and accept the invitation in those moments. All of that helps.
That's almost all we have time for. But before we go, I want to invite you to take a look at a new unbelievable course. It's called Did It Really Happen? The Birth of Jesus. Perhaps you've been asked questions about the historicity of Jesus, or maybe you have questions of your own. We've made an in-depth course with experts and theologians diving into the historical accuracy and arguments for and against the Jesus birth narratives. You will be guided through all areas of the discussion with N.T. Wright, Amiel Ewing, Daryl Bock, and others. Check it out by visiting premierunbelievable.com/courses.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.